Great to have you along on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here. We're going to take a look at the world of insects today with PJ Leash, manager of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. Always great to have PJ come by. And certainly, if you have questions, we're going to zero in a bit on caterpillars today because they're such really cool things, I think. We'll also, though, talk about some things, insects that maybe aren't so cool, some of those invasives. And take your questions as well. Give a call at 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. Email at talk@WPR.org or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. And PJ Leash, welcome back. Great to have you with us.
Pleasure to be here, Larry.
Well, we have a number of listeners have posted some great caterpillar photos on our Facebook page lately. Are there more around or more? Is it, you know, above normal this year?
Well, I mean, in general with insects, each year is a little bit different story. In terms of the pictures and reports I've been getting in the diagnostic lab, I have been getting quite a few caterpillar pictures and cases this year. So at least in some cases, some of the species seem to be up this year.
Somebody said, well, what really is a caterpillar? Are they all butterflies? And I said, I don't think they're all butterflies.
No. No. So caterpillar is a general term for the larval or juvenile stage of members of a group we call the order Lepidoptera. This group includes, of course, the butterflies, and we have somewhere in the ballpark about 150 or so different species of butterflies in the state. Most of them are going to turn into moths, though, and we've got a couple thousand different types of moths that are in Wisconsin and the Great Lakes area, so most caterpillars end up turning into a moth.
I saw some white caterpillars, or white moths, I should say. I wasn't sure what they exactly were, but they were flying around the garden, and small ones, about the size of a quarter.
Well, we have some cabbage butterflies that will be around the garden, around the backyard in general. We get these little slender whitish ones that feed on turf grass and lawn areas.
Oh.
So in terms of whitish moths or butterfly-like creatures, I could sit here and make a list of dozens and dozens of them.
Well, what gives a... Let's talk about the color, as long as we talk about... What gives a caterpillar its color?
So insects will have various pigments in their body, and in terms of caterpillars, some can be very bright and flashy colored. Some will have this coloration as a warning. For example, monarch caterpillars have very bright stripes, and they have ingested toxins from milkweed, and that's basically a way to warn other creatures, don't eat me, I'm full of some nasty compounds, and so that can serve as a warning. In other cases, some caterpillars can actually be quite hard to find because they are excellent masters of disguises, and they can be very well well camouflaged in some certain situations.
If you're a caterpillar, what's your life like?
Well, it all depends on the species. Some species can be fairly short-lived. One of our common indoor pests, for example, the Indian meal moth.
Yeah.
Can go through a couple generations in a given year if the conditions are right. Many of our outdoor caterpillars are going to go through probably one generation per year. Some can go through multiple, though, so it depends for each specific species of insect.
You know, I think when you mentioned monarchs and milkweed, that, to me, that's an interesting connection between the caterpillars and plants.
Yeah, so in some cases, and the monarch is a classic example of that, certain insect species will have a very narrow host plant feeding range. They may feed on one particular type of plant, like milkweed or milkweed and some of their close relatives in the case of the monarchs. Some of our other caterpillar species, for example, some of our giant silk moths, the Polyphemus and Cecropia and Luna moth and things like that, they can feed on a wide variety of hardwood trees. So again, it's one of those situations where it depends on each individual insect species in terms of what they nibble on.
Do you have a good resource? What's the best resource for identifying caterpillars?
Probably this one that I have right here in the studio. It's a Princeton Field Guide, Caterpillars of Eastern North America. This is my go-to guide. And if I remember correctly, I actually picked this one up at Barnes & Noble several years ago. So it's a very common one that you can find at a lot of bookstores.
Caterpillars of Eastern North America. Jill will probably put, of course I'll put that up on our Facebook page. So we'll have a link to that on our Facebook page. Well, boy, we've got email, Facebook questions and photos. Let's do the one photo, then we'll go to Phil in Hebron, Illinois. But Dion sent a photo of a really cool butterfly. It was on a black-eyed Susan. It's really pretty.
Yeah, so this is a small to mid-sized butterfly, kind of orangish and brownish in color. It looks like one of our checker spot butterflies. We've got a couple different species. They can be fairly common in some parts of the state. And a really good website I'd like to mention for identifying creatures like this, butterflies, there is a website out there by Mike Reese called The Butterflies of Wisconsin. And that is
perfect.
One of the go-to guides that I use around the diagnostic lab if I'm trying to figure out what I'm looking at in a given picture.
This one's really pretty. It's got more tan, but then a lot of gold and some spots on it. It's really pretty.
Yeah, and sometimes there will be closely related species that have fairly subtle differences in the colors of the wings, and so you really have to get some good pictures and sit there and compare them to tell the different species apart.
So go to our Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show. That's the title of the page if you want to see that butterfly, and I'm sure we're going to have a lot more as well. Now we'll turn to Phil in Hebron, Illinois. Hi, Phil. Thank you for calling.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Morning.
Hey, I got a quick one for you. I've got an open area, and we get a ton of tiger swallowtails, eastern tigers. And a friend of mine was out, and he's a trained ecologist with a master's. And we were walking around looking at butterflies, and we saw one tiger swallowtail that I would describe as having flown through a chimney flue. It was sooty. And we both got pictures of it, and he had never seen anything like it, and we thought that was real interesting. We've seen the totally black tigers, and, of course, we've seen the classic yellow tigers. We put it on the on a site to Cornell University that identifies butterflies and moths. One of their experts wrote back and said, you have a transitional morph of a tiger swallowtail somewhere between the full black and the full yellow. I wrote him back and said, how rare is it? He said, I'm 65 years old, looked at bugs all my life, and I've seen one. I wondered if you've ever seen anything like that.
Well, certainly an interesting observation. Personally, I have not seen a creature quite like that you described. I've heard of cases, and there are examples with other insects where half of the insect may have kind of a typical color pattern and the other half has something else. And if you think of the gene pool, there's a lot of different things that can go on, and every once in a while you end up with some weird kind of color pattern or other feature that just pops out.
Very interesting. We have an email from Mike in Algoma. He asked about tiger mosquitoes. He says they found one in his place this year, and they're horrible, he says. Wants to know if he can expect to see them every year, and will they survive the first light frost? It's really, I wonder if it's really a tiger mosquito.
Yeah, I wonder the same thing, Larry. We do have a species out there called the Asian tiger mosquito, and that's one of these species that is being talked about quite a lot because it can be associated with the Zika virus that we hear about in the news. We do know that that mosquito species is in some of the southern states. It does make it up a little bit farther north into the country, but we haven't found it in Wisconsin. We do have 60 or so other mosquito species in the state, and some of them have been very, very abundant this year in particular, just because of all the rain that we've had in many places in Wisconsin. And so I would suspect you probably bumped into one of these local species. The only way to identify that tiger mosquito would be to get it under a microscope and look at some very, very fine features.
That'd be interesting to see. Kathy on Facebook asked, when's the best time to spray the outside of your house to prevent the Asian lady beetles from entering the house? Just before the first frost?
Yeah, for the most part. In most years, those Asian lady beetles often start invading homes sometime in early October. Now, that can vary quite a bit depending on the weather's doing. Often the cue is when we get into roughly early October. We get kind of that warm period we often refer to as Indian summer, and we start getting a couple frosts at night around that time. And those are some of the cues that tell the Asian lady beetles to move inside. Now, when it comes to keeping them outside, We've got to go out before that, just before that, and put an insecticide treatment on the outside of our house if we're not able to seal up all the cracks and crevices. So right around this time of the year is typically the time we go out to do those sorts of applications.
And probably the sunny side of the sunnier sides of the house.
Yeah. Yeah. In general, they tend to like the spots that get the afternoon sun. So the south-facing side of the house or the west or southwest corner, we don't necessarily have to go all the way around the house because that north and eastern side, we don't see as many of them there.
Ron in Mason called to ask how to bait fruit flies.
Sure. So fruit flies, the common ones that we see around the kitchen sink and places like that, they are in general attracted to anything that gives off kind of a fermented smell. So fermenting fruit, even things like wine or beer can attract them. So in theory, you could make your own homemade trap with an empty 20-ounce soda bottle, a little bit of wine in the bottom or beer or mushed up banana, cut the top off, flip it over, make a little funnel out of it. Now, the thing to keep in mind with fruit flies, if you're seeing lots of them in a house, you can put out a trap, but what you're really doing is siphoning off some of the adults from the population. But if you're not getting to the root of the problem, the source, you're going to continue having them around. So it often takes some detective work looking for potential food sources that they're in to hopefully figure out and get to the bottom of the situation.
Something under the fridge or whatever.
It could be damp food under a fridge. It could be, you know, if you've got a big fruit bowl, there's one apple at the bottom that's gone bad and you can't see it. It could be a sink or garbage disposal where maybe there's a buildup of organic gunk. Any situation like that can be a potential breeding source for them.
We have, by the way, you can join in. We would open lines, get you on really quickly at 1-800-642-1234. Give a call. We'll get you on right away. Carol emailed to say that she would like an ID on a centipede between 2 and 3 inches long and as thin as a blade of grass. And in her colorful description, she says, very yucky.
So there are quite a few different types of centipedes that we have in Wisconsin. Now, I guess one thing we'd want to double check is that it is a centipede, not a millipede, because millipedes tend to be much longer and narrower in many cases. But we do have a group called the soil centipedes that are typically kind of a reddish brown color. They can be good size, several inches long, and they certainly would fit that profile. You can find them if you are tilling up your garden or if you were poking around in a rotting log, places like that is where you're most likely to bump into them.
And the difference between a centipede and a millipede, if you're looking at them?
Well, the technical difference, centipedes are predators. They've got some venom fangs up towards the front of their head. They've also got one pair of legs per body segment, whereas millipedes have two. Millipedes tend to be scavengers feeding on decomposing plants and the like. In theory, you could pick them up and count the numbers of legs on them. Not many people want to do that when they see something creepy and crawly. One of the easier cues to look at is the speed at which they're moving. Centipedes being predators, they tend to scurry fairly quickly. If you're a millipede and you're feeding on decaying plants, you don't need to chase down your dinner and kill it. It's already dead, so you don't have to move all that fast if you're a millipede.
Bonnie in Whitefish Bay emailed to say that, and she's right, on last week on Garden Talk, people were trying to get rid of milkweed beetles. She understands that they don't prey on monarch caterpillars, so she just leaves them alone. Is there a good reason to get rid of them?
Well, in the grand scheme of things, I'd say it's probably not worth the time to go after milkweed beetles. We have a couple different beetles we find on milkweeds. We have some reddish, about a three-quarters of an inch long, longhorn beetles, red with black dots. They don't really seem to do much damage to the plants. There's some smaller chrysomelid leaf beetles. There are some milkweed seed bugs that sometimes folks mistake for beetles. None of those insects really do a whole lot of damage to milkweed plants. And so in the grand scheme of things, do you need to intervene?
No,
probably not.
Probably not.
Probably simplest just to let them go.
PJ Leash, our guest today, manager of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network. Coming up at 1 o'clock today, Kathleen Dunn and her guest will talk about how our oversupply of facts is affecting politics and our perception of what is really true. That'll be an interesting one at 1 o'clock. Right now, taking a look at the world of insects for the state of Wisconsin with P.J. Leash of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. Larry Mueller here. And we'll turn to Marilyn and Cadott next. Hi, Marilyn. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Well, I've been listening to the show, and we have been struggling with mosquitoes in our bathrooms. And they're not biting us. They're on the walls, and they're, like, coming in around the toilet and in the showers. What's going on?
Well, certainly sounds like an interesting situation. The main question I have at this point is if they really are mosquitoes, because I can think of a few other tiny flies that might look somewhat similar to the naked eye that could show up in damp situations such as a bathroom. The thing we could do is if you're able to collect a few and put them in a little hard body container and send them in to me at the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab, I'll be able to identify exactly what they are. Once we know that, that'll give us some more information about where they may be coming from. If it is something like a true mosquito, they've got an outdoor source that they must be coming in through a window or some kind of vent, and they're sneaking in because they wouldn't be breeding indoors. But some of these other things that may look similar could potentially breed in the bathroom environment.
Oh, so in the drain or something.
Yeah. Exactly. We have drain flies. There are certain fungus gnats on occasion. If the conditions were right, if you had a leaky pipe or dampness in a wall void, they might potentially be able to breed. So, again, there's a couple other possibilities we need to rule out first.
Okay. Well, they don't bite.
Yeah.
They don't bite like mosquitoes.
So they're might not be mosquitoes.
Yeah. I really wonder then if there's something else
that
just looks similar.
Okay. All right. There you go. Good luck. And send some along to PJ and the Insect Diagnostic Lab. We have the address up on our Facebook pages.
Yeah, my mailing address for UW Insect Diagnostic Lab, it's 1630 Linden, just like the tree, L-I-N-D-E-N, Linden Drive. It's room number 240, and that's Madison, Wisconsin, and the zip code is 53706.
53706.
Just a general piece of advice to listeners. If you are ever sending a physical specimen in, make sure to put it in some type of hard-bodied container.
Like a pill box or something.
Yeah, empty pill bottle, small Tupperware, and then put that in a padded mailing envelope or a small box. If you just take the insect and put it in a Ziploc bag and throw that in an envelope, by the time it gets to me, it's completely smushed, which makes it pretty hard to figure out what it is.
We have lots of photos, by the way, now up on our Facebook page. Really nice one here from Owen of a swallowtail, pretty one. And then we've got Laura found these beetles on a butterfly bush in the garden at Lapham Peak State Park and wondering what they were.
Yeah, so this is a neat picture, and these are some fairly common insects that we see in late summer and early fall. They do look rather beetle-like, and they have this very distinctive bright orange and black appearance. These are actually one of the true bugs, This is a critter we either call a milkweed seed bug or a large milkweed bug. They often are in large aggregations where you can have adults and or juveniles all huddled together. These, I can tell in the picture, look like juveniles. They technically feed on the seed pods of milkweeds and butterfly weed and related plants. They don't seem to harm the plants a whole lot at all, so it's just one of these creatures that's out there on milkweed.
Nick, in Mundelein, Illinois, your turn now. Thanks for calling.
You're welcome. Thank you. Every November, December time frame, my mother gets 3 to 4 dozen flies show up in her house all at once, and it's been for 4 or 5 years in a row, and we can't quite figure it out.
Before the Christmas tree comes in, or?
I believe it's before, but that's a good question. I'd have to think about that.
Okay. I mean, this may be another case where it could be helpful to send in some physical specimens or email me some images of the insects. In terms of true flies, house flies and fruit flies and their relatives, it would be somewhat unusual to get an emergence of them indoors every year right around that time. There are some creatures, though, that can be associated with Christmas trees, and you bring the tree in, you set it up, the insects, eggs or other life stage, they warm up, they think it's springtime, and they become active, and you get them moving around the house. house. But it's a case where if we could get some pictures or see some specimens, that would really help us figure out what's going on and what's at the root of the problem.
Yeah.
And some of those insects that come up in with the Christmas tree may look like regular houseflies?
Well, if it looks like a regular housefly, houseflies themselves breed in materials like garbage and decomposing materials, but a lot of cases, if you had houseflies around the house, you would know that you've got a garbage can that maybe some food leaked out after Thanksgiving dinner or something like that. But to have that happen year after year just doesn't quite fit the normal pattern we'd expect with houseflies.
That's why I thought about that Christmas tree right away.
No, I like that idea. I'll explore that. I think you're onto something there.
Sure.
All right. Thanks, Nick.
Thank you.
Yeah, appreciate the call. Tony in Madison, your turn. Hi, Tony.
Hey, how's it going? Back to fruit flies. I know that fruit flies get attracted to fruit, but I want to know where the heck do they come from? It seems like that they just come out of just thin air. I'll take the response off here. Thank you.
All right. Thanks for calling.
Sure. So when it comes to fruit flies, we have our common fruit fly, the Drosophila species that you're likely to encounter around the kitchen area. There's actually a couple different families of fruit flies. So when we say the word fruit fly, it can mean a lot of different things to an entomologist. But for the common ones, as we just heard, they are associated with fermenting fruit and things like that. In general, they like anything that is kind of yeasty and fermenting. So overripe fruit. It could be some organic buildup in garbage disposal drain. It could be some garbage that leaked out of a bag, the liner, and got into the can, places like that. It could be a soda can that was left somewhere in the house unattended. Now, these insects just aren't going to pop out of thin air. If you're seeing them this time of year, often the case is there may be some outside and they simply sneak in, and if they find a suitable breeding environment, something sugary and fermenty, they can start to reproduce indoors. If it were winter, for example, we know they must have been brought in with some fruit or some other materials, or there's something else going on in the house where
There wouldn't be eggs there, would there?
Unlikely. I mean, most of our fruit flies, they go after fruit that is really starting to go.
Yeah. But I mean, the fruit flies don't lay eggs. They don't. So I was trying to think if they would come in as some other, you know, an egg or something on the fruit, and then if the fruit wasn't washed off and then decayed.
Well, potentially. In most cases, though, fruit flies, the adult females are specifically looking for that fruit that's starting to
rot.
Yeah, if you were to, for example, wander out into an apple orchard this time of the year, if you've got apples that have been dinged up or chewed on by other insects and they're starting to rot a little bit, all kinds of fruit flies will show up to cases like that.
Margaret in Seymour, your turn. Hi, Margaret.
Hi.
What can we do for you?
Yes, I have these little ants that come into my kitchen and they come in right by the electrical socket. And I have already got some bait stations for a week now, but it's not getting rid of them. Is there some way I can get rid of them, Dave?
Sure. Do you happen to know what type of bait you're using for these ants?
It's called Combat.
Okay. I'd have to look at the box for it to see what's in it exactly. The thing with ants is there's a lot of different species we can bump into indoors. Some of the ants prefer sugar-based foods. Some of the ants prefer more of a fat or protein-based food.
Yeah.
One of the easy ways you can tell, if you cut out some little pieces of wax paper and put out a sugary substance like jam or honey, and then put out something like peanut butter. That's got more protein fat. That'll tell us what they like to feed on. Now, the thing is, if you've got sugar-feeding ants and you're putting on a protein-based bait, they're going to walk right on by and completely ignore it. And so it seems like your ant bait isn't working. When it comes to ants, it's often just a matter of finding the correct bait that they like. Once you get a particular bait that they like to go to, you just keep putting it out, keep pounding it home until the ants disappear. And it sometimes can take about a full 2 weeks before they completely go away.
Okay, if they're sugar base that they like sugar. What type of a bait should I get for that?
Well, in general, if you go to the hardware store or garden center, you can often browse on the boxes, and it'll say for protein or fat-based ants, or it may say for sweet or sugar ants. And so if you look at the boxes and compare them, that can help you figure out a bait that may work better in your given case.
All right.
Okay.
Good luck.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Margaret, for calling. Arlen and Gillette, your turn.
Yes, I've got just a couple of quick questions. One has to do with little black flies that we see in the spring that are so pesky. Later in the summer, say in August, there are some flies that are about the same size that are just as pesky, but they're light-colored, not black. What are they? Are they variations of the same critter, or...
Well, hard to tell without me seeing the specimens up close. I mean, we certainly get a batch of what we call the black flies in the spring. And if you are into fishing or spending time outdoors, you probably have bumped into these.
Well, I'm well acquainted with them.
Those black flies are associated with streams. That's where the juveniles breed, but they can fly some long distances. Now, later on in the year, could you still bump into some black flies potentially? We've got a bunch of different species. Many of them don't even bite people, but there is some variation in the color. We do also bump into a creature called a no-see-um. And some of those can be somewhat similar in size and appearance to some of our black flies. And so I almost wonder if you might have bumped into some of those later in the summer.
Hmm. Would they be a lighter color sometimes?
They can be. With any of these flies, there's a bunch of different species out there. And so they can vary quite a bit depending on the exact species, if they're darker or slightly lighter in body color.
All right.
Okay. That's helpful. Just one other quick question. I do a lot of trout fishing, and I fish little streams and creeks in the big woods in northern Oconee County and Forest County, and I'm way back into swamps and all places like that. And this year, I've rarely had to use mosquito repellent. I've run into almost no mosquito, a few mosquitoes, but very, very few, unlike the typical year where they would pick you up and carry you away.
Yeah.
Do you know anything about that?
Well, so the mosquito situation has been interesting this year. In many spots of the state, including in Madison area here, the mosquitoes have just been terrible because of all the rainfall. But back in August, I spent some time up in Bayfield County, and where we were located, there were relatively few mosquitoes, a lot fewer than I was expecting. In cases where you get a lot of rain, you expect certainly to have mosquitoes a short time later, but in some cases, if you get enough rain and heavy enough rain regularly, it can actually flush away some of the developing mosquito larvae and pupae from the little pools or puddles they were developing in, and it may help wash them away. So it's always gets to be fairly complex with the mosquito dynamics.
So that could well be the case.
Because our rain was on a pretty regular basis, so that's probably it.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Just to go back to Facebook for a minute, PJ, Jacob sent a photo of an interesting-looking yellow caterpillar, I guess you'd say, with brown, sort of darker brown bands across it.
Yeah, so this one I can't quite tell off the top of my head. I'd have to zoom in a bit more. I almost wonder, there are certain beetle larvae that can have a somewhat caterpillar-like appearance as well. Some of our glowworms, for example. So I'd have to sit there for a while and figure exactly what this one is.
Kind of a pretty one.
Yeah, definitely.
John in Fitchburg, your turn. Hi, John.
Hi, PJ, Larry. Question I have is, there's a small fly that appears in the house from time to time. I've never seen one outside. It's about half the size of a normal house fly, I would say. But when it perches on the wall, it looks sort of like its wings, like an aircraft with swept back wings. You know what is, Mikey?
Sure. So the key there was with the description of the wings. My suspicion, hearing that, is we have a critter out there called a drain fly, and sometimes we also call them moth flies. If you bump into those, they're not uncommon to see them in the bathroom on occasion. What those insects do is the larvae live in really damp organic gunk. And so what that tells me is that there may be a kitchen or a bathroom drain that maybe has a little bit of buildup, and you got to get some Drano or other drain cleaner or an enzyme product to remove that stuff, which is their breeding habitat, and that would cause them to disappear as well.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, thanks for calling. Back to Facebook here, we've got a photo from Tammy who wonders if this is an imperial moth caterpillar. She found it in the Germantown area.
Yes, so this one is an imperial moth caterpillar. This is one of our giant silk moth caterpillars in the state. And the caterpillars themselves can get to be a good 3 to 4-ish inches long. They're often kind of a pale greenish or greenish-gray color. They've got some kind of spike-like structures up near their head, and they have a little bit hairy appearance. And I've actually gotten quite a few reports of these lately. So this is a caterpillar species that seems to be having a pretty good year in the state.
Yeah, a good example of it. Let's go to Zachary in Dodgeville next. Hi, Zachary.
Hello.
What can we do for you?
I just wanted to make a comment about the caller who mentioned tiger mosquitoes. I lived for about the last 6 years in South Korea, where they have tiger mosquitoes. And just about, I don't know, 2 or 3 weeks ago, I was really surprised to see some here in Dodgeville, Wisconsin.
Well, so again, and we discussed this a little bit earlier, we haven't found Asian tiger mosquitoes in the state yet, and there certainly are folks out there looking for them, including Susan Paskowitz, our medical entomologist in the department here at UW. There are roughly 60 mosquito species in the state, and some of them can look almost identical to the tiger mosquitoes. You really have to get them under the microscope to be able to tell them apart.
And what would be the difference? How would you tell them apart?
Well, there's some very subtle features in terms of coloration on the body and presence of scales and certain locations if you know right where to look. With the naked eye, in order to identify tiger mosquitoes, it just really can't quite be done. You need to sit there under the microscope to tell them apart, because we do have some native mosquitoes in Wisconsin that are pretty closely related. They're not associated with Zika, but they can look very similar.
If you catch some, put them in a pill case or pill box or something, and send them in.
Yeah.
I do a lot of macro photography, so I'm going to dig back and see if I can compare the two. But to me, it's very similar, and I have looked at them roughly 21 times.
Oh, okay.
Yep.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Well, I'm sure Susan Paskowitz would be very interested to know. So if you've got some, even some really good photos, you might send them along to the Insect Diagnostic Lab.
Yeah, I can always take a peek and see what I can find out.
Let's go to Tom in Mequon next. Hi, Tom. Thanks for calling.
Hi, guys. This may be more of a question for an arborist, but I think I've got an issue with woolly aphids infesting some beech trees that I have. I've got some branches on these beech trees that look like they're flocked white, and then underneath them I get a lot of what I think is the sugar, the sap from these aphids. And I tried to spray them, but I can't get the spray up high enough, so I'm wondering whether a systemic is something I can use to control these aphids.
Sure. Well, so there is an issue with beech trees in the state, and we do have a little insect that gets onto them, and it is whitish and fuzzy in appearance. Now, a concern with that is there is actually a disease that can be carried by that insect and cause problems with the beech trees. So overall, that may be something to have an arborist come out, take a peek, and get an overall assessment of what to do about your tree in that case.
Yeah, and I've probably 10 good-sized beech trees that have this issue on it.
So
it's probably time to have an arborist come out.
Yeah, probably. Would an arborist be able to put a systemic down? Or?
Well, potentially. I mean, we can control aphids with some of these systemic products. There are restrictions on the product labels in terms of how many trees you can treat on a per acre per year basis, and so you'd have to really do a site visit to figure out what the most appropriate course of action would be.
Yeah, there you go. Thanks, Tom.
Thanks, guys.
Sharon in Belmont, your turn.
Hello.
Hi, what's on your mind today?
I wanted to tell that lady with an ant problem how I keep ants out of my house, and it's so easy. You put like a bar of hand soap around different places in the kitchen. I have one right behind my toaster, one by my mixer, one on the counter by the sink. I just put them in the back on a piece of wax paper, and the ants do not come in. And we have ants all over our yard outside.
Mm. What might be going on there, PJ?
Well, so we know that ants, in general, sometimes they won't like a certain smell. And so I've heard of folks trying soap and, you know, vinegar and cinnamon and essential oils and things like that. And there may be some truth to that, in that if you put down a substance that has a fairly strong smell, the ants may avoid that general area. But in terms of scientific research done behind that, any of those effects generally tend to be fairly short-lived. And so just putting out a couple bars of soap, you might have just gotten lucky in a case like this, but in terms of keeping ants out, a better, perhaps more permanent solution, see if there's any cracks on the outside of your house or gaps around a door where they sneak in, and try and tighten things up the best we can.
Yeah, there we go. Thanks, Sharon, for calling. Appreciate it. Katie in Eau Claire, it's your turn. Hi, Katie.
Hello, thank you for having me.
Sure.
My question is just, I guess, about the Asian ladybugs, because I've heard so many different stories behind how they got here and what their purpose is or was. So I'm just wondering.
Yeah,
sure. So there's a rather interesting story behind that one. And the short answer, how did they get to the U.S.? Well, we probably brought them here. If you look back over the last century or so, there's been a lot of instances where we have brought that species in from Asia for use as a biocontrol agent. They happen to be pretty good at feeding on aphids. And so if you're a farmer, you know, you don't mind having these things out in your farm field to control aphids and soybeans and the like. And there were several introductions where folks brought these Asian lady beetles in. They didn't seem to quite catch on. And then in about the 1980s, they seemed to pop up in force. So was it one of our purposeful introductions? Did it accidentally get in here? We don't know for sure, but for whatever reason, it got in at some point in the last century, really took off in the 80s, and it's something that we've got around in the state and many other parts of the country, and I think we're going to be dealing with them for quite some time.
Oh, there you go. Thanks, Katie. Appreciate it. Wade in Appleton, your turn. Hi, Wade.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I understand the emerald ash borer has moved into our area, and I've got more than a handful of ash trees. And I'm just wondering if it's worth pursuing some kind of systemic preventative action, or if I just need to kind of enjoy them while they last and kiss them goodbye.
Now, how many do you have?
Six.
All right.
Okay. And the six, are they in a fairly small yard, or do you have a decent-sized yard?
It's a fairly small yard.
Okay. I mean, there's
half an acre.
Okay. There certainly are products out there that can be effective at protecting ash trees. The long story short, if you don't treat your trees, it's probably only a matter of time before they're killed by that insect. If you do choose to treat, we have effective treatments. Some of them you can apply yourself. You can find the products at the hardware store, and you'd apply them to the soil in spring, for example. There's also the option to hire an arborist. One of the benefits of hiring an arborist is the arborist can get some different products that homeowners wouldn't be able to get their hands on, and they use specialized equipment. They drill tiny holes. They inject the material just beneath the bark of the tree. Now, if you read that product container, it says it will protect trees for at least 2 years at a time. But I've seen an awful lot of university data, including some of our research trials here at UW-Madison, that have shown that those products can protect trees for three, maybe even four or so years at a time. So I've heard of cities that are treating their ash trees about every 3 years to help maintain the health of the trees. Now, in the grand scheme of things, if you think of those trees in terms of property value, if those are the only trees in your yard, you know, that's really going to change the look and feel of your yard. So it may make sense to do something to maintain the health of those trees.
Excellent. Yeah, I've got one maple and one locust to go with it. Locust. Otherwise, it's the six ash trees. So
true.
Good. That's very helpful. Thank you.
One other thing I would mention briefly, Chris Williamson and I have a couple of fact sheets that we update every year in the spring where we have gone through and reviewed the types of products that are out there for treating your trees for emerald ash borer. So if you just do a Google search and find those, that will give you your options both for the do-it-yourself route and also what options are out there if you do choose to consult with an arborist.
And so you'd Google, what would you Google?
I would, probably the best place to find them, if you went to the UW Extension Horticulture website, which is hort.uwex.edu. And if you just type in emerald ash borer in the search box on that page, you'll be able to find them.
There we go. Thanks again for calling. Appreciate it, Wade. P.J. Leish, our guest today, director, head of the UW Insect Diagnostic Lab, our guest here on Garden Talk. No, not on Garden Talk, on our regular shows here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Taking a look at the world of insects today with P.J. Leish, who manages the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining us. Questions, give a call at 1-800-642-1234. You can post a photo up on our Facebook page, and we've got some dandies up there. Go to the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page, and you can post your photo there or take a look at the photos that others have put up. Here we've got one. Let's see, who's this from? It's a pretty nice shot from Owen here. This was found in Florida. Maybe a hawk moth?
Well, potentially. With the hawk moth group, there's usually a horn at the back end. And I will admit for this one, I don't know what it is off the top of my head. And the reason for that is if you look at the patterns of insects in the country, many of our insects are found throughout much of the eastern U.S., but you get down to the southeast corner, especially Florida, they have a lot of creatures down there that we don't have up here. So I have not seen this particular caterpillar before.
All right. And I don't know if you're going to be able to check this out. Barbara wonders what this might be.
So this is a neat creature. These are teeny tiny little creatures, and they're related to spiders and scorpions.
Yeah,
they're a type
like
of arachnid.
A spider.
And we've got a name for them. We call them pseudoscorpions because if you look at the front end of that picture on Facebook, they've got the scorpion-like pinchers.
Yeah.
Up on the front of the body, but there's no tail off the back end. And these can be fairly common if you know where to look. Occasionally they show up in homes. They feed on tiny insects that are around. So it could be carpet beetle larvae or clothing moth caterpillars and things like that. You also can bump into them outdoors. If you were peeling the bark off a rotting log, you might bump into them there. And they're just, in general, tiny predators. They might be an eighth of an inch long or so, and they're just feeding on things that are about their same size.
Karen in Edgerton up next. Hi, Karen. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, hi. My question is, one evening I saw 18 monarch caterpillars on my milkweed plant. I was thrilled. The next day, they were all gone. And my plants are under a bat house. And I'm wondering, would the bats eat the caterpillars?
Well, in general, I have not heard of bats eating monarch caterpillars before. Bats, what I think of their typical diet is flying insects, moths and beetles and things like that. One other thing that could be going on, though, and I have a strong suspicion about, there are all kinds of wasps, yellow jackets and paper wasps. They can come in a very short period of time, kill all kinds of caterpillars. And in some cases, paper wasps and yellow jackets can be such good and such efficient predators that they can make it difficult to do things like butterfly gardening, because if you've got those insects nearby, they can come in, and once they find a food source and recruit other workers from the colony, they can wipe out a lot of caterpillars very, very quickly.
Oh, and I do have bees around.
Yeah, that's probably what happened.
Yuck.
There you go. Thanks for calling. Gene in Menominee, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi. PJ, I have a real unusual bug here. It's it looks squarish, and it's got a clear area around the outside with its two antennae that stick out. It's about 5 millimeters on the side, and it almost looks like it's got hands and feet that stick out, and it's dark, and it's really very unusual. So I thought, well, it's so strange that maybe just based on sort of a size and general description, you might be able to say, oh, yeah, that's whatever.
Well, I will admit I'm scratching my head a little bit. One question for you, Gene, is the creature still alive or is it dead at this point?
At this point, it's dead. I threw him in a jar, and it's been in a jar waiting for you to come on again.
Okay. In some cases, I've seen even common things like some of our stink bugs, the juveniles, if they die, sometimes the body curls a bit, and so that could potentially give a squarish shape.
No, it was square when it was alive.
Okay. Mm. I can think of a few spiders that have some weird shapes.
And what's unusual about it is the clear, like, webbing around the outside.
Okay. Mm. We do have some creatures called lace bugs that can have this clear lace-like or web-like pattern on the body, although I typically don't think of them as being kind of square-shaped. What would really be helpful in this case is if you're able to snap a few pictures.
I do.
Okay. Yeah, if you have pictures and can email them to me, I can take a peek. That'll at least be a good starting point. If I can't tell for sure from the pictures, I may have you send in the actual specimen for me to take a closer look, but that would be a really good starting point for us.
Is the email on the public radio website? Or
yeah, if you go to the, well, it's the Insect Diagnostic Lab. If you go to that, you can go to our Facebook page and just click on it.
I don't go to Facebook, so give me another source. Yep.
If you just did a Google or Internet search for UW Insect Diagnostic Lab, you should be able to find my website pretty easily, and I've got all my contact information right on that website.
All right, I'll find it. Thank you.
All right, thanks a lot for calling. And just, Gene says he doesn't go to Facebook, and that's fine. You don't have to be a member of Facebook to go to our page. So that's just a notice there. And Dan, in Watertown, your turn. Hi, Dan.
Hello, PJ and Larry. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a question about apples. I've got a couple dozen apple trees, various varieties. And I'm curious to know, right now it seems to be wasp heaven out there, yellow jackets and these big ugly black ones, more black than yellow.
Yeah.
I'm wondering, is there a way or do they possibly pierce the integument, the skin of the apple, to start some decomposition and then all their friends come in?
Probably not.
Okay.
When I think of wasps, so yellow jackets and paper wasps and things like that, they can actually be fairly common in orchard-type situations. I think of them as being secondary or more of nuisance pests. They aren't really going to go in and start damaging fruit. What happens, though, is if the fruit is damaged or compromised by anything else, it could be a fungal disease that opens the fruit up and it starts fermenting a bit. It could be damage from another insect. Something else happens. That fruit is injured or damaged, and then all kinds of insects, from yellow jackets to Asian lady beetles to other things, will get in there and start feeding on the damaged fruit.
Yeah, there's a whole host of different critters that compromise this fruit, and I had a lot of frost ring this spring, so I didn't bother to spray.
Mm-hmm.
But it seems that they're really, really focusing on the Honeycrisp and the yellow apples. The harder apples don't seem to have the same problem. And obviously it could be a blight or it could be a rust or something like mm-hmm. that might have been started
it.
Yeah, I would think there's probably something else going on that started it, and the yellow jackets and other wasps just showed up to get food. And I guess if we have a second to talk about wasps and yellow jackets, they are very common this time of the year. I've gotten a lot of reports lately. Those creatures start their nests from scratch in the spring, And so they often go unnoticed, but the colony builds up in size until late summer. And so now is the point where the colony is at about maximum capacity. They are desperate for food. And so they are out in force scavenging at dinged up apples and other fruit. They're going to the recycling and trash cans to go after soda and things like that. And so they are very, very abundant at the moment. Give it a month or so and we get a couple hard frosts and they're going to knock off for the season, though.
Yeah.
Well, thanks for the answer.
Yeah, thanks for calling. Chris in Darlington, your turn. Hi, Chris.
Hi. My question is I live in an old building, and it's covered with vines, and even some of the windows are covered with vines, and lots of birds, like little finches and sparrows, are hanging out in the vines. And so when you look through the window, it's like looking inside of a tree. It's kind of cool. But I had really bad fleas this summer, and I was wondering if that having the windows covered with vines with all the birds was contributing to the problem.
Well, a couple thoughts here. I mean, in general, fleas tend to do better under damp, more moist conditions. And so if we had a really dry year like 2012, it probably would have been harder on them. But we had a lot of rain and very regular rain this year. So could that have affected a little bit if the vines over the windows held in moisture? It could have made the indoor environment more conducive for them and easier to survive. But in terms of birds, I wouldn't expect them to be a huge factor. When I think of fleas, the first thing I always ask folks about is indoor pets, dogs and cats and things like that. But there are cases where our common fleas can also get onto outdoor critters, other mammals, raccoons, and if you have squirrels in a wall void or something like that. And so I would expect, the source of the fleas to probably have been some type of mammal around.
Okay, great.
Oh, great.
I like looking at the birds. Okay, thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Chris. Thanks a lot for calling. And Sue in Madison asked if the chemicals for treating ash trees are bad for bees and other friendly insects.
Well, depends on how they're used. Now, whether you talk about the insecticides used for ash trees or pretty much any insecticide, even some of the organic insecticides, if you are putting them and applying them in a spot or a condition where bees are going to be exposed, there can be risks to bees. Now, in a case like this with ash trees, a lot of folks have asked about this last couple of years because we do hear in the news about pollinators. If you think about ash trees in general, though, they're wind-pollinated trees. There's not a whole lot of evidence that bees go to them. And so because of the way that we're applying it, the overall risk to bees should be minimized.
And we'll be back right after this look at the news. Stay with us. Great to have you along on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here taking a look at the world of insects today with PJ Leash, manager of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. Always great to have him along. Questions, call at 1-800-642-1234, email at talk@wpr.org. Or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. And if you've got a photo, post that as well. We're getting a lot of great photos today, and we'll get into that in a minute. But I want to give Janice a chance to join us from Antioch, Illinois. Janice, thanks for waiting.
Hi. I have a really unusual type question. I am 77 years old, and when I was maybe between 12 and 15, my cousin, my uncle, and I were standing out in front of their house on the edge of Chicago, in Cook County area, and we saw this huge butterfly or a moth back then. I didn't know the difference between a moth and a butterfly. It was yellow with a sour cherry red size head. The wings were approximately the size of my hands, which aren't huge, and it came down low. We almost caught it. It flew up and over the house, and we followed it for a couple of blocks and couldn't catch it or see where it went. And we have no idea. I've looked in museums. I've looked in, like, the Field Museum in Chicago. Every time we go on a trip, we would go to a museum to see if we could find a sample of it. Nothing. Looked in books, nothing. And we often wondered if it blew in on a storm.
That's always a possibility that it blew in on a storm. We do get some weird things, and anytime you have a big storm front come through and the jet stream has dipped down. I mean, for example, I regularly, a couple times a year, will get some very, very large moths from Mexico, like the Black Witch, for example, that will make it up here to Wisconsin. So we always have to keep something like that in mind. There are some pretty good-sized moths that can have wingspan of several inches. The imperial moth would be a common example. Wings are mostly yellowish. They can have some darker patches on the body that might be sometimes purplish or brownish, potentially pinkish. We have some decent-sized butterflies. Some of our sulfurs can be yellowish on the wings and maybe have a little bit of pinkish red up towards the head. So this is a case where there could be quite a few possibilities. We'd have to sit down and have looked at a picture of it or a physical specimen to really know for sure, though.
Oh,
well, that's a long time ago.
Yeah. I'm sorry we can't.
It was so yellow and so red. I mean, the head was bright, bright red. I mean, it was... We were just awed.
Oh, man.
I wish and it wasn't a day back then you didn't have a camera where you could go snap, snap. You had to stand there with your little box and back off till it got in focus. So none of that was available then.
I'm afraid it's a mystery.
Yeah.
Thanks for calling. Well, maybe somebody else has seen one like that in Mexico or someplace when they were traveling. I don't remember ever seeing anything quite like that. All these years later, Janice still remembers it, so it's pretty cool. Mike in Sheboygan, it's your turn. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Larry. Hi, PJ. Thank you. Very excellent show. Thanks to Garden Talk and all of your naturalists, I'm in the process of converting my mother's Southside Sheboygan suburban lot into a pollinator habitat. I even got certified by Wild One, so... One thing I've learned is to let things alone. So when everything's getting eaten, I let it go because I figure something else is going to eat that. I didn't know that hummingbirds were going after the spiders, but I saw that in action. Now that today we've been talking so much about wasps and yellow jackets and whatnot, I've actually tried encouraging them by getting them into fruit bowls away from the back deck so that they have something to do, figuring something else is going to eat that. Now, a few weeks ago, Larry, you had a naturalist on who said that wasps and yellow jackets do, I think the caller asked, what possible good do they do? And in this case, I'd like to know from your guest, what eats the wasps? What natural predators knock those guys down besides the first frost?
Yeah,
sure. So a couple things. I mean, certainly there must be some birds that feed on them. Now, I'm not a bird expert myself, so the exact species of birds that might nibble on them, I just don't know off the top of my head. But in general, birds wouldn't surprise me that they would nibble on wasps, either the adults or if you think about the wasp nest, something like a paper wasp nest, if the workers have dispersed, there's a lot of young, the larvae in the nest, that's a protein source, really packed closely together. So birds, some small mammals might go after cases like that and eat them. There's a long list of mammals that will, in general, feed on insect larvae, be it grubs in the soil or in other locations.
And you scared the heck out of me because you just said that the wasp will go after the monarch caterpillars, and here I am transplanting milkweed like crazy. I do have a lot of milkweeds here for being in the middle of town, and I have a lot of monarchs, but no caterpillars. And I thought, oh, my gosh, I just fed them steaks to all the wasps.
Sure. Well, I mean, if you think about the benefits of wasps, they are excellent predators. So if you have a garden, you know, you've got squash and beans and things like that, or tomatoes with hornworms, it can be a good thing to have the wasps around because they're going into your garden, they're collecting the caterpillars to feed to their young, so they can provide what we would refer to as biological control. It's pest control that Mother Nature is kind of doing for us. But on the other side, they can be such good predators that if you are trying to do butterfly gardening, it can make it challenging sometimes because if you're really, trying to get those monarch caterpillars to go through and become adults and you got a lot of wasps around, they can make it hard to do.
Mm.
Understand.
Right.
Okay. Well, thank you. I'm just going to let everything go as it is and let Mother Nature take care of it. Thanks, guys, for a great show.
All right. Thanks, Mike. Appreciate the call. I want to go back to Facebook for just a minute because here we've got a really cool picture. It looks almost like a green torpedo with a yellow strip running around the sort of the cone end of it.
Yeah, so this greenish pod, this is the chrysalis or pupal stage of the monarch butterfly. And they're always this beautiful greenish color with a gold stripe on there. I can tell this one, I'm starting to see some of the spots through that casing to see the developing wings beneath. So this one, I'm guessing the adult would have emerged not terribly long thereafter.
Yeah, it's a pretty cool picture. If you want to see what one looks like, go to our Facebook page. Again, you don't have to be a member to go and look. I'd encourage it because it's pretty cool. And a photo of a hummingbird, a clear-wing hummingbird?
Yep, a clear-wing moth. Yep, and we have some that we call the hummingbird clear-wing, and there's a couple closely related species, and they behave just like a hummingbird. Makes a very similar noise. They sit there and hover in front of flowers. They have a long tongue-like device that they uncurl and stick down into flowers to sip nectar, and they're just fun creatures to watch.
Yeah, they sure are. John in Fond du Lac, your turn. Hi, John.
Hi, I'm the take-up speaker. So I have a problem with silverfish. I remodeled my kitchen in June. I've been in this house for 8 years. I've never seen silverfish. Then I did a kitchen remodel, sink, dishwasher, new countertop, drywall, insulation, and now I see silverfish. It's not a lot, but like one every night running around my counters or sometimes on the floor, always around the sink area.
Okay. Well, in general, when I think of silverfish, I think of damp conditions. If you had a home in a part of the country, you know, the Southwest where humidity is lower, you know, good luck trying to find silverfish in a lot of cases. If you have humid conditions, then they can do a little bit better. Now, if you've had a renovation, if they've, you know, taken windows out or anything like that, or you had the doors open a lot this summer for construction crews to come in, or if you've just been having the windows open with the amount of rain we had, humidity is probably up, and that can make it a little bit more favorable. Now, in addition to humidity, silverfish, they typically like to avoid the light. So they like the tucked away cracks and crevices in kitchens, beneath sinks and places like that. So one of the things we can do, because silverfish don't reproduce terribly quickly, is go to the hardware store and purchase what are called glue boards. And it doesn't contain any pesticide. It's cardstock or a plastic tray that's got really sticky glue on it. And if we can put these in tucked away locations, under a sink, behind some cabinets, under a stove and places like that, that way when the silverfish wander across them, they're going to get stuck and die. So that's one thing we can do. Other things we can do around the house to get the humidity down, run the furnace fan or AC or dehumidifier, that may help as well.
There we go. Good luck. Thanks a lot for calling. Quickly back to Facebook because we got a really cool picture here of a monarch just coming out.
Yes. Yeah, so this one, I wonder if it's from that same chrysalis picture, but a beautiful picture of a recently emerged monarch adult. It looks like it's still in the process of unfolding and hardening its wings, which can take a little bit of time before it's able to actually fly once emerging.
Loretta sent that. She sent some really nice photos pretty often. It was great to see. Arlene and Rhinelander, your turn. Hi, Arlene.
Hi, I have a problem with cobwebs and spider webs in the house this summer and last winter, way, way more than I ever have before, and I'm wondering what's going on. There will be a lot of times Daddy Long Legs in them, but I, you know, if I try to get it, the Daddy Long Legs squirts, runs off, and then sometimes I see little tiny spiders. What's going on?
Well, so I see on the call board you're from Rhinelander, Arlene?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, up in that part of the state, with all the lakes you have around, there's just a lot of insects in general in the Northwoods because we got mayflies and midges and stuff come out of lakes. Anytime you have a lot of insects around, that's food for spiders. And so with the damp conditions this year, a lot of reports I've been getting insects may be up in the North Woods, and so if you had a lot of food for the spiders, doesn't surprise me that much that you'd have a potentially more spiders around this year. I know it certainly can be frustrating if you have a lot around. They sell you know, extension handle sweepers to get the corners of your rooms to get rid of the webs and the spiders themselves. If we had a drier year, I probably wouldn't anticipate as many spiders.
Yeah.
I even noticed them last winter, though, during the winter, too.
Mm-hmm.
And it's relatively dry in my house in the winter because I do have to even run a humidifier sometimes.
Sure. Sure. Well, you certainly still can find spiders around in buildings, homes, and the like during the winter months. What that tells me, if you have spiders around, they are predators of, for the most part, small insects. And so if you've got spiders around, that tells me there's something else around the house that they're feeding on. So it
well,
may be...
I had a lot of problem with those darn orange ladybugs.
Okay. Well... The Asian lady beetles, they often get up into soffit areas and places like that. If they were down in the house more, could they potentially be fed on by spiders? That's a possibility. But all kinds of other things, other insects, ground beetles, and lots of insects you can find in the house that would be a food source. I would look at the spider as more of a secondary issue. You've got other insects around that they're feeding on. If we can figure out what those are and eliminate those, then if the spiders don't have food, they're going to kind of fizzle out on their own.
All
okay,
right.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for calling. And John in Milwaukee, it's your turn. Hi, John.
How you doing, Larry? Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Hey, I've got a question about walking sticks.
Okay.
So, as a kid, you know, we saw them and thought they were unique, that sort of thing. And I'm 50 and never saw a lot of them growing up. Just very rare here in Milwaukee. But now, this past summer, I've got a, you know, a wooded lot here in Milwaukee, and I mean, I've got a ton of them. You know, one Saturday, I swear I counted about a dozen of them. What maybe changed, you know?
Yeah.
So from my experience, walking sticks, they tend to be kind of hit or miss in the state. In some places, you just don't find them. In other places, you may bump into a bumper crop of them, and it may have to do a little bit with weather, but also the type of food that they like to feed on. Now, in the state, we actually have about three or four different species of walking sticks. They really tend to like to feed on things like oak leaves and the leaves from raspberry bushes and things like that. They might nibble on leaves of grapes a little bit here and there from what I've heard. If you've got the right habitat for them, it's not surprising that in a given year you just could get a big batch of them. One spot in the state that I fairly consistently can find decent numbers of them is up in parts of the Baraboo Hills. Places like Devil's Lake State Park, where you've got an awful lot of oak trees together, raspberry bushes and brambles out in the woods. So as I said, sometimes if you're just in the right spot at the right time in a given year, you can find an awful lot of them.
Hmm. Very cool.
These are as big as my hand. These are huge.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, some of them, I've seen them get to be 4 or 5 or so inches long, so they can be pretty good-sized insects.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, John. Appreciate the call. We have a photo here on our Facebook page from Chris. He's got an insect on an envelope with, a quarter next to it and wonders what it is. It may be hard to tell from that photo.
Yeah, so the photo itself is a little bit blurry, but given the shape of the body, the shape of the wings, and I only see two wings, what this looks like is one of our crane flies. These are the creatures that sometimes folks think they look like gigantic mosquitoes, and they do kind of have that general of appearance, but they don't bite. They are associated with damp areas. Some of the larvae can live in streams. Some will live in rotting logs in places like that or damp firewood. But they also can come to porch lights at night. And so if you ever see something that just looks like a gigantic mosquito hanging out at your porch lights, it's going to be one of these crane flies.
Very cool. Well, let's see. We've got some others up here. I think you and I talked about this off air. I don't think we talked about it on the air. But here's is this a Chinese praying mantis? It's a really cool picture.
Yeah, so this one, certainly a praying mantis, looks like probably our Chinese mantis. We also have a European species in the state. They have an interesting history in Wisconsin because they're really not native here. But as our climate has generally warmed up, these creatures that can be found more readily in more southern states, we tend to find them along the Lake Michigan counties and the southern areas of the state. So because that one was found in Lake Geneva area, it kind of fits the profile of where we often bump into praying mantids in Wisconsin.
And Kurt, my old buddy Kurt, sent a photo of a tussock moth, is that?
Yeah, so this one...
Caterpillar.
Yep, has a very fuzzy black and orange appearance. This is the milkweed tussock moth caterpillar. They can be very common on milkweed plants. If you were growing milkweed for monarchs and you had an awful lot of these, you know, can they nibble on enough leaves that it might be a concern? Potentially, I've never really seen it get to that point. If you've got a large patch of milkweed, they're probably not worth worrying about a whole lot.
And we get a couple of photos of this particular insect from different people. Terry wonders, what kind of a spider is this? We found it on a field next to our house. It looks like maybe an orb.
Yeah, so this one is one of our classic orb weaver spiders, and I can't quite tell from the angle of the picture which species it is. We have a good handful or more of different orb weaver spiders that can be very common in late summer, August and September, even into early October. They often have very plump abdomens, bright, flashy red, orange, yellow coloration on the body, sometimes some white spots. Neat creatures to look at, though.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, now I'm having some trouble. Yeah, there's another orb spider. And let's see. We've got, if I can get one more up here. I'm having some trouble moving my mouse here today. Oh, gosh. Well, I tell you what. We had some other questions from emails. David emailed to ask if chiggers and no-see-ums are the same thing. And Catherine on Facebook says she thinks she has chiggers 50 miles north of Green Bay. Would she possibly have them, and how can she stop them from coming back next year?
Well, so could potentially be chiggers. We do have chiggers in Wisconsin. Now, chiggers are a juvenile stage of a type of mite, so they are something different from no-see-ums, which are a type of fly. In general, chiggers aren't terribly common in Wisconsin. If you went to southern states, you're much more likely to bump into them. And they really need kind of brushy areas with lots of vegetation to do well, because they are actually parasites that go onto other creatures. But if humans wander into a raspberry patch, or if you're, you know, golfing on the golf course, you ended up in the woods and you could bump into them. In terms of eliminating them, the ultimate solution would be to modify the habitat. That might not be feasible. If you had turf grass area, for example, that's typically too open, too sunny, too dry for chiggers to do well in. If you have dense vegetation and converted that, that could be an option, but as I said, might not be feasible.
Bob in Minocqua emailed to ask if ants can fly.
Yes, yes, we have all kinds of flying ants. Now, for a given species of ant, most of the time you might see the wingless workers, but when that colony is getting ready to reproduce and create new colonies, the colony will produce winged males and females that leave the nest, and they go mate with individuals from other colonies. And I had a lot of reports the last couple of weeks of swarming or winged ants on a warm, sunny afternoon, and you could have tens of thousands of winged ants flying around in your backyard.
Kristen emailed to say that black and orange caterpillars are scurrying back and forth across the bike paths in Madison, often to their demise, sadly. What do these become, and where are they going? They seem to vary widely in size.
Well, this would be a case. It'd be great if Kristen sent me a picture of these so I can narrow down what they are. There's quite a few orange and black caterpillars that we could potentially bump into this time of the year. There also are some creatures that look kind of like caterpillars, the larvae of sawflies. And I know of a few species that can also kind of be orange and black in color, and sometimes they can be present in large numbers. So I'd have to see a picture on this one to really narrow it down.
All right. And let's see. I think we've got another one or two. Up here, I wanted to get everybody's questions in, but I think maybe we've gotten most of them in. I think there was another identification one, but I'm having trouble with my mouse. My mouse isn't working, and here we are close to being out of time here. Any other invasives that we should be looking out for?
Well, we do have a new invasive beetle that showed up this summer in Dane County. It's called the Japanese weevil, or sometimes folks call it the two-banded Japanese weevil. And unfortunately, that name is rather close to another invasive, the Japanese beetle. Oh. Ironically, weevils are a type of beetle, so hopefully we don't get this one too mixed up. But it's a tiny black and grayish beetle, feeds on a wide variety of landscape plants. Where it came from, how it got here, we don't know at this point. We'll have to keep that one in mind for the coming years.
Well, PJ, it's always great to have you with us. I know you're going to be back on November 16th, so we'll certainly look forward to that. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Sure, pleasure.
PJ Leish of the University of Wisconsin-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. Great to have him along. He's back November 16th. And Rick Seney comes by tomorrow to talk about air travel. And hope you'll join us for that. Stay with us. Lots more in store here on the Ideas Network.